Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week, I'll have readings from the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. I'm going to wrap up the program with readings about food and culinary traditions from New York Times Magazine, Bon Appetit, The Guardian, and I'm starting with this. Behind the Gates, Inside the Wealthy Black Community That Inspired a Soap Opera. This was written by Brandon Drennan and published March 3, 2025 at the British Broadcasting Corporation news website. Behind the closed gates of the Country Club at Woodmore lies a world of power, luxury, and one of America's wealthiest African American communities. Located in Prince George's County, Maryland, one of the wealthiest majority black counties in the United States, the Country Club and its attached gated community is the epicenter of the area's upper crust. Although it traces its roots back to plantation-era slavery, the region has become synonymous with black excellence, locals told the British Broadcasting Corporation. To live there, Patricia Gafford says, you've got to have money, lots of it. Though Mrs. Gafford is a dues-paying member of the private country club where she often plays golf, the 73-year-old says she does not live inside the gated community because, as her husband once told her, it's a little bit too rich for us. The setting has also inspired a groundbreaking new soap opera called Beyond the Gates. Its second week of programming begins on Monday, March 3rd. Beyond the Gates is the first new daytime soap opera on network TV in over two decades and the first hour-long daytime soap with a predominantly black cast on network TV. Kristen Warner, an associate professor of performing and media arts at Cornell University, says seeing its release feels long overdue. Black folks have been huge supporters and viewers of soap operas since its inception, she told the BBC. Yet, with over 90 years of soap opera history, there has never been a black family as the main family from the start of the show, she explains. She says, Beyond the Gates shows that black families are just as capable of embodying the soap opera essence of elegance and glamour and style and fashion, as well as the trademark messiness of the daytime plot lines. The show is set in a fictional posh Maryland suburb called Fairmont Crest, and centers on the Dupree family. While its daily drama-filled plot lines are sure to be in classic soap opera fashion, over the top, the setting was inspired by the very real exclusive enclave inside Prince George's County. The long winding road that leads up to the Country Club at Woodmore is lined with big brick houses built like castles and surrounded by expansive manicured lawns. A Maserati, Mercedes-Benz, or something similar decorates most driveways. The depth of wealth in the black community was also a surprise for Sierra Bobar, who moved to Prince George's County from New York City in 2023. It was kind of like a culture shock for me to see black people with these mega houses, Miss Bobar says. In Woodmore, where census estimates say over 80% of the population is black, the average median household income is over $214,000. The average in the U.S. is just over $80,000. Miss Bobar, too, plays golf at Whitmore's course, where she occasionally hosts events for her Women of Color-centered social club, City Girls Golf. She says Beyond the Gates has been all over social media and that everyone is excited about how it's putting a spotlight on a little-known hub of black affluence. The next section of the article is titled, From Slave Plantation to Elite Country Club. Long before it was an axis of Washington, D.C.'s black elite, in the 1800s, Prince George's County was once known to house the most enslaved African Americans in all of Maryland, says Susan Pearl, a historian at Prince George's County Historical Society. One of the largest plantations in the area, Pleasant Prospect, was located where Whitmore's gated community now stands. The street leading into Whitmore's gates carries the same name. Some of these wealthy, successful black families are living on land where hundreds of enslaved people were working for one large white property owner, says Ms. Pearl. The county was predominantly black following the Civil War, but that changed after a wave of violence against African Americans drove many of them away, says Maya Davis, chair of the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture. Black Americans started returning to the area en masse in the early 1970s after a court ordered the county to desegregate its schools. The area soon became known for its affluence. At the time, the federal government, which employs many people in nearby Washington, D.C., was one of the first to implement anti-discrimination policies, giving black Americans a rare chance at better opportunities and better pay. Federal jobs played a huge role in creating black economic success, Ms. Davis says, leading to Prince George's County eventually becoming the wealthiest majority black county in the U.S. By the late 80s, McMansions owned by black families began popping up, she added. Meanwhile, the county's white population continued to decline as large numbers of white residents began leaving the District of Columbia area in a phenomenon called white flight. Yet, it wasn't until 1992 that the Country Club at Whitmore admitted its first black member, nearly 70 years after the club first opened in 1923. He died last year. The next part of the article is titled, A Black Family at the Heart of a Daytime Drama. The history-making Beyond the Gates arrives at a strange time, media professor Ms. Warner says. The soap opera is nearly extinct. For most of soap opera's history, she explains, black characters were secondary to the story, introduced through the lives of white families, initially in roles like housekeeper, then later as cops and lawyers. NBC soap opera, Generations, made history in 1989 when it became the first to feature a black family from the beginning. But this will be the first soap to make a black family the star of the central plot. The soap is also airing amid a backlash, spearheaded by President Donald Trump's administration, against diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Beyond the Gates was born out of a collaboration between CBS and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in 2020, following the social uprising of the Black Lives Matter movement. It was a gesture of goodwill that Ms. Warner says is now being rolled back. In the midst of everything being taken away, we have this one little moment where there is something there for us, Ms. Warner says, referring to the soap. The next section of the article is titled, Everybody Wants to Be Behind the Gates. The club's black members say that despite a shifting political climate, Whitmore, with its rolling hills and towering pine trees, remains a safe, familiar place. When I came onto the grounds, I see people who look like me, says Miss Gafford, a member. It's great to come in and see Brent Taliaferro behind the counter, she adds, referencing the club's assistant golf pro, who is also black. We all feel like we're one big family, the Whitmore family, he agrees. There are a few people at Whitmore's club Mr. Taliaferro doesn't know, including Hope Wiseman, who grew up inside the gates of Whitmore. She believes the name of the new soap opera is aptly titled. Everybody wants to be behind the gates, so it's funny they called it Beyond the Gates. Everybody wants to see kind of what's back there, Miss Wiseman says. She opened a cannabis dispensary down the road in 2018, making her the youngest black woman at the time to own one. It's success stories like these and people like Miss Wiseman, black entrepreneurs and black dentists like her mom, that aren't on TV screens enough, she says. That's why Miss Wiseman says she is pleased to see this new soap opera depicting her community. A lot of people don't understand what it's like to grow up around and operate in an environment where there's black excellence all around you, she says. That's not the experience of most of black America. That's exciting to see on TV. That was the article, Behind the Gates, Inside the Wealthy Black Community That Inspired a Soap Opera. This article was written by Brandon Drennan and published March 3, 2025 at the BBC News website. My next article is about the mayor of New York City. The title is, Five Things to Know About the Rise and Fall of Eric Adams. This was written by Matt Flagenheimer and Dana Rubenstein and published in the New York Times Magazine on March 8, 2025. Mayor Eric Adams won his office 4 years ago, pledging to deliver New Yorkers from chaos and calamity, a former lawman entrusted to tame a proudly unruly city. It hasn't happened that way. Over nearly 100 interviews with aides, allies, and adversaries spanning Adams' life and career, the Times Magazine found a mayor and a city unmoored, their fates entwined whether or not residents want them to be. Long before his indictment last fall on federal corruption charges, Adams became the avatar of New York's day-to-day disorder, a volatile leader to match and contribute to volatile times. His chosen path out of his personal crisis, many details of which have not been previously reported, involving cozying up to a new president whom most of Adams' constituents oppose, and offering those constituents, federal prosecutors have said, as human collateral to the Trump White House. Here are five takeaways from our reporting. Adams and Trump have played the long game. President Trump and Adams, two sons of Queens, seem to understand each other from the start. When Trump encountered the mayor at a charity dinner in October, weeks before the presidential election, he put his arm around him in private. Adams' friend, former Governor David Paterson, said that Adams was quiet for the rest of the night. Almost like he's thinking about it, Paterson said. Like, is this possible? Boy. Trump urged Adams to hang in there before publicly suggesting that both men had been persecuted by the Biden Justice Department. Adams, a Democrat who criticized Trump's idiot behavior during the president's first term, has not said a cross word about him since. By January, he was flying to Florida to dine with Trump days before the inauguration. And Trump had acquired a useful new friend in his native city, a mayor straining to cling to both his office and his freedom. Adams is a political shapeshifter. Adams has always been an adaptable politician, comfortable flip-flopping between the two major parties as the wind shifted. He was a Democrat, then a Republican in the 1990s, then a Democrat again. He briefly considered running in 2021 as a Republican, and he has considered it again in 2025. In an interview, Tucker Carlson suggested Adams had formerly been intimidated into supporting things he doesn't believe, and said he and the mayor have a lot of gut-level agreements. Adams was so open to Trump world that he even considered attending Trump's October campaign rally in Madison Square Garden, Carlson told us, before deciding against the idea. Eric always was more right of center, the Reverend Al Sharpton told us. He was not a fellow traveler. The migrant crisis was Adams' first major test as mayor. The city's migrant influx became a defining management crisis of Adams' term, decisively shaping his relationship with two presidents. Joe Biden was trying to hang me out to dry, the mayor told members of Congress visiting City Hall in 2023, according to an attendee. By 2025, the Trump administration, pushing for a dismissal of Adams' corruption charges, said the mayor needed to be uninhibited in assisting the new White House's deportation agenda. But Adams' views on immigration are more complicated than is widely understood. He has greeted asylum seekers personally upon their arrival to New York and slept on a cot in a tent shelter. He also predicted, long before his indictment, that the issue would destroy the city, amplifying fears about migrants committing both petty and violent crimes. Adams is often loyal to a fault. I'm going to make sure my people are taken care of, Adams said privately just after his win in the primary, noting that the white mayors before him did the same. And so, rather than choose a cabinet based solely on expertise, he created a city hall divided between technocrats and cronies. The fallout has devastated City Hall and rendered it rudderless. By his fourth year in office, nearly all of Adams' most trusted aides had left amid investigations and scandal, including Adams' chief advisor, police commissioner, interim police commissioner, first deputy mayor, and schools chancellor. Bill Bratton, a police commissioner under two previous mayors, diagnosed the problem. Too many friends with too many problems in too many high places. Adams has long tied his own story to the city's. Adams has repeatedly told his audiences, "I am you." At his most effective, he has woven his biography, as a scofflaw youth who became an officer who became the mayor, into New York's own tumultuous and resilient history. "The mayor must fit the characteristic of the city," Adams said last year. He does, especially now. Self-regarding, sleepless, fast and loose, saddled with nighty crime problems. His legal duress has unfolded against the backdrop of a city that can feel as if it is losing its collective mind, unsettled by a reef of semi-surreal scenes, from the subways to the streets that New Yorkers encounter every day. Maybe Adams is New York, but New York might not be his for long. That was the article, Five Things to Know About the Rise and Fall of Eric Adams, written by Matt Flagenheimer and Dana Rubenstein. It was published in the New York Times Magazine on March 8, 2025. My next reading is titled, "United States Department of Agriculture Reopens 1890 Scholars Program for Florida A&M University and Other Land-Grant Historically Black Colleges and Universities After Suspension." This was written by Tara Jean and published in the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper on February 25, 2025. Just days after suspending the 1890 Scholars Program, the United States Department of Agriculture has reopened it for prospective agriculture students interested in attending Florida A&M University and other historically black land-grant universities across the nation. The USDA 1890s National Scholars Program application period has been reopened, and applications will be accepted through March 15th, the USDA said on its website Monday evening, following a previous announcement about it being suspended pending further review. "It's a win for Florida A&M University and other land-grant HBCUs. If the scholarships are not reinstated, they would no longer have future cohorts of students going through the decades-old program." Despite the short suspension period, FAMU's College of Agriculture and Food Sciences Dean Garland Wade Wesson said the university remained committed to supporting scholars in the program. "We will continue collaborating with our supporters and corporate partners to ensure students have access to opportunities in agriculture and food science," Wesson said in a statement sent to the Tallahassee Democrat. The program suspension came as part of President Donald Trump's directives during efforts to cut all federal assistance that may conflict with his recent executive orders, including ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. But with the application portal being reopened, students are handed back the opportunity to apply. The 1890 land-grant institutions are HBCUs that were established with federal land grants under the Second Morrell Act of 1890, which required states to establish those colleges and universities for black students. Through the scholarship program, established in 1992, students from underserved communities are given scholarship money to attend one of the 19 land-grant HBCUs for a full 4 years for specific training related to agriculture, as well as animal science, botany, forestry, and more. Besides Florida A&M University, other HBCUs in the program include Alabama A&M University, Fort Valley State University, North Carolina A&T State University, and Tuskegee University. The USDA Scholars Program gave $19.2 million in scholarships for HBCU students in the 2024 fiscal year to provide them with full tuition, fees, books, room and board, and Florida A&M University gets $39,000 per student each year for scholarships through the program, according to a spokesperson. That was the article, USDA reopens 1890 Scholars Program for Florida A&M University and other land-grant HBCUs after suspension. This was written by Tara Jean and published February 25, 2025, in the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper and its Tallahassee.com website. My next story is out of Georgia. The title is, Wren's Nest Museum in Atlanta Reclaims the Narrative of Br'er Rabbit. This was written by Brooke Howard and published February 13, 2025 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. The subtitle to the story is, The Trickster Originated in Tales Told by Enslaved Georgia Griots in the 1800s. Just before one crosses Lake Oconee in Putnam County, Georgia, a gated property sits on the right side of the road. Blink at the wrong moment, and a state historical sign with information about a famous writer can get muddied in a blur of serene green fields rolling eastward on the famous author's driving tour. Another sign noting the location of the Turnwold Plantation sits just a few feet away and informs visitors that this part of the tour is dedicated to Joel Chandler Harris, the white man who published the tales of quick-witted Br'er Rabbit in the 19th century. However, other storytellers appear to be missing from the Turnwold Plantation plaque. Enslaved griots were the originators of the tales Br'er Rabbit, sharing adapted West African fables after long days working. This is Black History, writer and historian Jim Achimute said. It comes with a little bit more complicated framing, but this is Black history. Harris encountered the griots of Turnwold Plantation in 1862 when he was hired as a printer's apprentice at 16. After assisting the enslaver and owner of the estate, Joseph Addison Turner, Harris ventured to the cabins of enslaved African Americans to hear tales about critters. He would go down to the old slave cabins. He would sit and listen to those stories, said Linda Walker, director of the Uncle Remus Museum in Harris's hometown of Eatonton. He was fascinated by them, Achimute said. The underlying theme of the fables is that animals, like rabbits who are prey, are being really clever and outsmarting the people who are trying to get them. It doesn't take a scientist to figure out that that has a lot of resonance for people who are living in slavery. In the stories of Br'er Rabbit, the trickster always finds a way to outsmart his would-be captors, Br'er Fox and Br'er Bear. Storyteller Gwendolyn Napier of the Wren's Nest in Atlanta, the house museum where Harris relocated after leaving Eatonton, said Br'er Rabbit serves as an unmistakable metaphor. When you think about how those stories are twisted and told, it was always the rabbit who took time to outwit everyone. And I ask this question all the time to my audience. Who do you think the rabbit was, really? The enslaved individual or the master, she challenged. They always said the enslaved. She said that Br'er Rabbit's character had to be wiser than his enemies. The enslaved people were not ignorant, Napier explained. They knew ways of really coming out of all the mess that they were going through. So the stories had, in my opinion, a very significant message. Achimute, a member of the advisory council of the Wren's Nest and former writer with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, explained that the storytellers included an Aunt Minervy and Old Harbert. Storyteller Georgia Smith of the Uncle Remus Museum in Eatonton said she learned about a woman called Aunt Chrissy while growing up as a black child in segregated Eatonton. We were taught these stories were African folktales and that we should tell our story. We should pass it down to the family, Smith said. So that's what we always did. When I was a child, everybody was a storyteller. Neither of the historians could place the fifth griot of Turnwold, but both Achimute and Smith agreed that Uncle George Terrell was the main inspiration behind the creation of Harris's character, Uncle Remus, a storybook amalgamation of the enslaved narrators. George Terrell is by far the best known one, Achimute said. Achimute explained that reporters went to interview Terrell after stories of Br'er Rabbit became popular in the 1880s, a period after the Civil War when many other formerly enslaved people engaged in the Great Migration. However, Terrell State put in Turnwold. I don't know how old he was, but I'm sure he was a pretty elderly gentleman at that time, Achmute said. Like a lot of black people who had been enslaved in the South, after emancipation they didn't know anything else. They stayed pretty close to home. Not much else is known about the tellers of tales at Turnwold, but the stories they shared have spread into cultural phenomena that are still enjoyed around the world. The books have been translated in 20 languages around the world, and historians have speculated that the characters Peter Rabbit and Bugs Bunny were inspired by Br'er Rabbit. Disney also bought the rights to the stories and made the film Song of the South in 1946. Unfortunately, Achmute said, that version distorted the integrity of the Br'er Rabbit African folktales by creating a narrative around a happy, formerly enslaved man who became a sharecropper and joyously spent his free time telling stories to white children. There are a million ways to imagine now how they could have told that story better, Achmute said. But in the context of that time, if they had just made him not seem so damn happy-go-lucky about being a former slave, that probably would have helped. To ensure Br'er Rabbit's cultural accuracy, Achmute said the Wren's Nest changed the focus of the narrative and solely hired black orators. Beginning in the 1960s, black civil rights leaders John Lewis and Reverend Ralph David Abernathy and Michael Lomax also joined the museum board. As a storyteller, I can be stuck with hatred. I can be stuck with racism all of my life. But I'm trying to show the next generation how to move on a little bit, Napier said, comparing the black American experience to the mythological Sankofa bird. I'm like the Sankofa bird. I'm looking back. I never forget, she said. This bird is always looking back at what happened in the past, but you have to look back to see what's in the future. Still today, Napier said, black people can relate to Br'er Rabbit when they get stuck in housing and food crises. She said racial injustice is another obstacle, but channeling the will and strength of African American ancestors can prove triumphant. And channeling the wisdom of the Turnwold Griots who pushed Br'er Rabbit into an evolutionary international icon has given Napier a sense of self. Each time I stand right here before I tell a story, I always focus right here, and he reminds me of why I am here, Napier said, standing in front of a central portrait of Terrell at the Wren's Nest. I know who I am as a storyteller. I know my purpose on this earth as an African-American person. That was the article, Wren's Nest Museum in Atlanta Reclaims the Narrative of Br'er Rabbit. This was written by Brooke Lee Howard, and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 13, 2025. Coming up, a reading about food titled, Why the Black American Origins of Mac and Cheese Are So Hotly Debated. I found this in the Guardian newspaper and its theguardian.com website. It was written by Anika Okona, and published December 22, 2024. It stood on my kitchen bookshelf, Sylvia's Family Soul Food Cookbook, from Hemingway, South Carolina to Harlem, with its ashen purple spine and gold lettering that twinkled in the November light. In what felt like a taunt, the book's presence made me reconsider a takeout Thanksgiving on the couch. Since 2021, I've lost both parents, which has consumed both my heart and my usual cooking mind, dampening my desire to reach out for the familiar. The cookbook, a portal to my childhood and one of my mom's favorites from her massive cookbook collection, had a traditional recipe I knew I had to try. Golden brown macaroni and cheese. I'm a black southern woman and cook with roots in Georgia and Alabama, so making mac and cheese was not something I needed formal instruction to execute or master. But in the past few years, the way I've made my mac and cheese with bechamel-based roux and too many fancy cheeses I can't pronounce was no longer satisfying. I started to crave the old-school way of making it, the way our aunties, older cousins, and grandmas made it, with eggs, country crock or imperial margarine, elbow macaroni noodles, evaporated milk and a smattering of sharp cheddar cheese with its characteristic bite and twang. The online debate about the different ways to make the popular soul food side, roux or no roux, has gone on for years, reappearing like clockwork every holiday season. This discourse, fueled by posts on X, Instagram reels flaunting gooey roux-based cheese pulls, and TikToks of users defending their family's traditional versions, is almost always intense. It's mainly because it is informed by the flawed assumption that there is one rightful, authentic way for Black people to make mac and cheese, the culinary centerpiece of many of our gatherings. As a result, the tension goes far beyond what one might consider petty social media arguments. These ideas and arguments surface over time, said Psyche Williams-Forson, Ph.D., the chair of the American Studies Program at University of Maryland College Park, and the author of the James Beard Award-winning book, Eating While Black, Food Shaming and Race in America. Part of what I know happens is we as Black people and we as people are so unaware of our history that we think everything is new and novel. If we would release that nostalgia and be more informed about our histories, perhaps we wouldn't have so many devastating challenges in our thinking. Only then might one note, for instance, that James Hemings, a formerly enslaved man who became America's first French-trained chef, is largely credited for bringing macaroni and cheese to the United States in the late 18th century. Hemings made mac and cheese in the roux style that so many of us unknowingly return to in modern times. In the decades after Hemings' introduction, though, Black Southerners, many of whom had previously been enslaved, used what ingredients they had on hand, creating a more simplified version with the egg custard base, which then led to its widespread adoption as the original. Williams-Forson added that recipes are not static, but instead are ever-evolving, changing with climate, available resources, palate preferences, and regional variances. In a video about the innovation of Hemings, who learned to make mac and cheese in France as a companion to his enslaver, Thomas Jefferson, the food historian Karima Moyer Nochi noted the historical development of the dish. While mac and cheese started off as an ancient Roman festival food, different renditions have always been part of its story. The colonial-era cookbook, The Art of Cookery Made Plain and Easy, had perhaps the earliest recorded recipe of mac and cheese. But another very popular book in the colonies was Elizabeth Raphael's The Experienced English Housekeeper, Moyer Nochi said in the video. She has a recipe that is actually called macaroni and parmesan, where the thickening takes place with a ball of butter that is rolled in flour. A very common way of thickening then. She's also got cream in it. Seeing the mac and cheese commentary online this time around showed me something I wasn't otherwise aware of. There were others like me looking back to the way we used to make it, reaching for those recipes. Those of us who shirk off internalized shame that taught us we needed to make changes, swapping out cheddar for smoked Gouda, Grieri or Fontina, in the name of elevation. And that there were many others overwhelmed with grief, like I was, that shaped how or what they cooked. The reasons for this are clear. Black families like mine have seen unprecedented levels of loss in the past 4 years. A 2-year assessment examining the COVID-19's pandemic's impact on children, for instance, reports older Black Americans aged 65 to 74 as 5 times more likely to die from COVID than white Americans of that age. Our elders, those aged 75 to 84, died from COVID nearly 4 times more than those of white Americans. This means countless Black children lost either a parent or caregiver during those early years of the pandemic, and many had been the keepers of food rituals within our families. With those generational losses, many of us attached impassioned feelings to a dish that is much more than just food. Hemings, for his part, paved the way for all our family's renditions, whether roux-based or not. Black Southern cooks like our enslaved foremothers and later generations of women like Sylvia Woods of the famed Sylvia's Restaurant in Harlem were the true progenitors of mac and cheese. Though Wood's restaurant is still open, her death in 2012 crystallized the heaviness of what we continue to lose when it comes to our food and the indelible memories attached to it. Who will capture these culinary heirlooms? Are newer generations up to the task of passing the baton? Some of those generations are joyously embodying the newfound culinary responsibility without the heaviness of obligation. Jordan Ali, a spiritual worker from Denmark, South Carolina, believes the commentary online has been interesting to watch. Her two-part TikTok series, Ben Country, features her 81-year-old grandmother, Rosa Tyler, in real time making her mac and cheese. I used Ali's TikToks along with the recipe in Sylvia's cookbook to help steal mine. I felt like I needed to document the recipes I grew up on, Ali said about her decision to post her grandmother cooking online. I learned how to cook because I stayed with my grandmother. I was adopted by her and she was my guardian for the first part of my life. It was also a way to honor her. Ali sees these recipes as tangible mementos of her lineage, recipes she's determined to preserve for herself and future generations. She's getting older and I want documentation for myself, for my children to see, for my siblings to look at later down the line, Ali said. It's not just cooking. It's really communing with your elders. They're telling stories. They're cooking. You're talking. You're laughing. It's an experience. It's spiritual. This is ritual for me. Ritual is also taking things from the past and using them as memory keepers to fuel how we move forward in the future. In an era punctuated with persistent loss, in times that continue to confound, our culinary rituals are a scrumptious bridge, one that connects us to what can never really be lost or forgotten if we insist on remembering. That was the article, Why the Black American Origins of Mac and Cheese Are So Hotly Debated. I found this in the Guardian newspaper and its theguardian.com website. It was written by Anika Okona and published December 22, 2024. Next out of New York Times Magazine is a story and a recipe. The title is A New Orleans Legend's Incredible Cornbread. This was written by Lisa Donovan and published at the New York Times Magazine's website on March 5, 2025. The subtitle to the story is The Late Pablo Johnson, a New Orleans fixture, was known for bringing people together at his beans and rice dinners. When Southerners talk about cornbread, they're really talking about where they come from. More specifically, they're talking about the people they come from. You might think the differences in cornbread are marginal, the list of ingredients often identical. Yet the preparation, the kind of pan used, the type of fat, whether leftovers are crumbled into sweet buttermilk for days after until it is all gone, as my family did. They all tell a story about someone's table and, quietly, something about his or her life. If there was one person whose cornbread told you about his life and his table, it was Pablo Johnson, photographer, writer, and keeper of ties. Like many folks, specifically those he referred to as my people, the community he built across the globe, I call Pablo a dear friend, in my case for over 15 years. I am honored to say I've made this cornbread with him many times in many places for groups large and small over the span of those years. He and I were reminiscing about those times recently on a sunny Saturday in New Orleans as we talked about possibly publishing his recipe here in this column. It was the week after a great snow fell in the city where both of our hearts found a kind of love and acceptance they needed. The next day, Pablo was gone. He collapsed during what he loved, photographing a second line parade as he did every Sunday he could. Quite suddenly, this recipe became a memorial. This cornbread comes to us from one Achille Leon Herbert, Pablo's Cajun maternal grandfather of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It is not altogether too different from mine, really, just a little flour added, oil instead of butter, slight differences in the bake time. We each make ours in hot cast iron skillets and celebrated good cornmeal and buttermilk. We didn't have any tricks, just a geeky dedication to those two ingredients. Every Monday that he was in his beloved New Orleans home, Pablo would serve this around his grandmother's table, along with his red beans and rice. He also served it during his traveling road show. If you ever got to attend one of these dinners, it was easy to understand how one person could build a whole community of people around one unchanging menu. You would arrive at Pablo's house, and the red beans and rice would be ready and waiting. The table would be modestly set, and the cornbread would still be baking, nearly every time. This was a little exposition. Southerners like to pull you in with your nose first, give you a reason to step off the porch into the house. We all love to watch Pablo pull the pan out of the oven, loosen its edges just a bit, and then, with humble aplomb, flip his cornbread and butter and salt it generously, serving it bottom side up to share all the toasted flavor with his eager guests. The list of diners was ever-changing, and every time you attended, you would invariably meet strangers who became friends. It seemed to be the goal, to get his people around his table so they could become one another's people too. That was the real magic of this meal, and it was Pablo distilled, a way of seeing what he most dedicated himself to during his full but too short life. I know cornbread can just be cornbread, but Pablo's recipe was love actualized. Of course it had strong practice and great technique, but it was also full of good intention and generosity from his bright, beautiful, seemingly boundless spirit. His cornbread became yours, almost a communion welcoming you in as part of his tribe. And as you sat across from him at that hallowed table, ready to tuck in, he would pass you the pan, seeming to be asking, "Where's your home?" and responding, "Right here for now," all at once. Next is the recipe that comes along with the story. Skillet cornbread. This cornbread recipe from photographer, documentarian, and writer Pablo Johnson is a simple and rustic standard. Baked in a hot skillet to encourage crispy edges and a substantially toasty bottom, cornbread is traditional to many regions in the South. This recipe was passed down by Mr. Johnson's grandfather, Achille Leon Herbert, from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and it was served every Monday at Mr. Johnson's legendary red beans and rice community table at his home in New Orleans. It traveled with him across the country on his Red Beans Roadshow, where he collaborated with local chefs and served dozens of communities over the span of almost a decade. Ingredients. Yield: 1, 9 or 10 inch cornbread, 8 to 12 servings. 2 cups medium ground cornmeal. 1 quarter cup all-purpose flour. 4 teaspoons baking powder. 1.5 teaspoons coarse kosher or fine sea salt. 1.5 cups buttermilk. Tip: if you have multiple options when choosing buttermilk, look for brands that have no stabilizers. 2 large eggs. 2 tablespoons of sugar or honey. 1 quarter cup of vegetable oil. Salted butter for topping. Flaky salt for topping. Preparation. Step 1. Heat the oven to 425 degrees. Place a 9 or 10 inch cast iron skillet in the oven to warm up for at least 10 minutes while you prepare the batter. Step 2. Whisk together the cornmeal, flour, baking powder, and salt in a large bowl. Step 3. Whisk together the buttermilk, eggs, and sugar in a liquid measuring cup or another medium bowl. Step 4. Using a spatula, stir the wet ingredients into the dry ingredients, just to combine. Do not overmix. Some lumps are fine. Step 5. Carefully move the hot skillet from the oven to the stovetop, turning your burner to medium-high heat. Add the oil. Remove from the heat and swirl to coat the bottom and sides of the skillet. Pour the hot oil into the batter. It will sizzle. And whisk very vigorously until well combined. Step 6. Pour the batter, which will be slightly thick, into the very hot skillet, distributing it evenly. Place the skillet back in the oven. Bake the cornbread for 20 to 25 minutes until the center is set and the top is lightly golden brown. Step 7. Let cool for 5 minutes. Then loosen the edges and flip the cornbread in the pan. Melt butter on top and sprinkle with some flaky salt to serve. Store any leftovers wrapped tightly in foil for easy reheating. That was the article and recipe, A New Orleans Legend's Incredible Cornbread, written by Lisa Donovan and published in the New York Times Magazine's website on March 5th, 2025. My final reading today about food is from the magazine and website Bon Appetit. The title of this article is How These Black Culinary Entrepreneurs Keep History Alive in South Carolina's Lowcountry. This was written by Cynthia Greenlee and published February 28, 2025. The subtitle to the story is As We Toured the South Carolina Coast, these Stewarts, from a crab catcher to a custom knife maker, showed how to build off history, not be bound by it. Few U.S. cities have so profitably capitalized on their past and their food ways as Charleston, South Carolina. Founded in the late 1600s near Oyster Point, it was one of colonial America's metropolises, fattened by slavery and competing with New York City and Philadelphia in population and port city swag. On the shores of the Atlantic, the region birthed the dynamic Gullah culture and communities of black fisherfolk who gave America shrimp and grits, crab rice, she-crab soup, and the one-pot wonder, Hoppin' John. In this region, land, sea, and black labor converged to leave a culinary imprint that has traveled far beyond the Carolina coast. But no matter how much Charleston touts itself as America's most historic city and a bastion of authenticity, cities and foodways survive because reinvention is perpetual. As we toured the South Carolina coast, African-American culinary entrepreneurs showed just how to build off history and not be bound by it. Land and Legacy, St. Helena Island. On a drizzly fall day, Sarah Reynolds Green gathers a mess of collards, hugging the bouquet with both arms. The embrace represents the philosophy she shares with the students ages 10 to 17 who attend Marshview Community Organic Farms Young Farmers and Chefs of the Lowcountry program. When you're out here growing food, your heart has to be clean. Your vibration has an effect on the universe. Green and her chef hunter husband, Bill Green, teach the students farming basics on her family land. She picked peanuts, corn, and okra here as a child before going to Spelman College in Atlanta. In Georgia, she got involved with the legendary, now defunct, community health food store, Life's Essentials, and several schools that promoted racial pride, good health, and collaboration. If we can't work together, we can't work, she says. The students tend crops, from sowing in the greenhouse to harvesting. The program also gives their family seeds to start home gardens to cultivate Gullah land connections that have been lost to time, off-island migration, and encroaching development. But Green remembers, and she wants to teach because it pains her to hear some youngsters say of agriculture, I don't want to do that slavery job. The Call of the Water, Brittle Bank Park. Tia Clark gently shakes the contents from a crab cage onto the pier off Charleston's Brittle Bank Park. She holds aloft a cerulean Atlantic blue crab, fingers safely away from its flailing claws. This beauty is a male. You can tell by the pattern. People say the males have a Washington Monument on their underbody, and the mature female a capital with a pointed dome, she says. Clark, founder of her casual crabbing with Tia ecotourism venture, sounds as if she's always known these things. Black people have worked the waves around Charleston since Kingdom Come. But though she's a Benya, Gullah for been here or a native as opposed to a Cumya, this was recent knowledge for her. Clark found the waters after she left behind years of bartendering and hard drinking. A cousin took her out crabbing, and heeding a call she didn't quite understand then, she began fishing alone. She made the outdoors my gym, shedding pounds and gaining peace. Today she leads popular tours during which guests accompany her on the water, keep some of the catch they net, and take it home or to a local restaurant partner to cook. We all have a right to these natural resources, and it doesn't matter where you come from, how much money you've got, she says. And I want to empower and teach young black kids in the region that our culture is directly connected to the water. If you don't have a relationship with this water and know this water, you probably don't know who you are. History of Ancestors, the Middleton Place Plantation. Distant cousins Ty Collins and Robert Bellinger both descend from some of the 3,000 people enslaved by the Middletons, a prominent Charleston trading and political family. At the Middleton Place Plantation, beside its garden shop and visitors parking, they've planted the Assay Garden. It's a small collection of raised beds of herbs to honor the enslaved people whose labor made the estate's world-renowned formal English garden possible. On a recent walking tour, Collins pointed out how enslaved and free people literally shaped the landscape as its primary gardeners and engineers. From its famous stands of camellias, bamboo they planted as fencing, and the strip of earth they constructed between the plantation's rice field and the Ashley River's mix of salt and fresh waters. A 14-year-old girl would have been responsible for this, he says, pointing to a watery quarter acre of a demonstration rice field. But little is known of what that girl and her family would have grown to eat in the slave quarters. Bellinger, a Massachusetts-based historian of West African griot traditions, has become a de facto food historian to solve that mystery and hopes he'll soon be able to plumb Middleton Place's private archive to find out. He and Collins are advocating for a larger garden space that's more connected to the property's core, where they'll grow plants linked to the African diaspora. The Bene seed that's a symbol of the region, guinea corn, probably a sorghum or millet, and a tomato that might have traveled to North America during the Haitian Revolution. Pushing boundaries. Bluffton. Extreme fidelity to regional specialties can dampen diners' appetites for the novel or a broader history. Bernard Bennett, chef and co-owner of O'Conn Restaurant in Bluffton, 90 miles down the coast, pushes boundaries. His menus offer the holy trinity of rice, seafood, and greens, but much more. Guyanese pepper pot, or a nod to his Senegalese grandmother in Nebe, a black-eyed pea salad. There will always be rice on this menu, he states. A recent menu offered three, including jollof, West Africa's precursor to Low Country red rice, vermicelli with Haitian flavors via Dijon mushrooms, and turmeric-tinted Carolina gold rice. He's firm that shrimp and grits won't make an appearance as he explores less-traveled pathways that led to African-American food. When he debuted the West African greens and melon seed stew Egusi, it languished on the menu until he rebranded it as spinach soup and instructed servers to describe it as hearty winter comfort in a bowl. He tries to stimulate customers' curiosity, adding glossaries to his menus, but does not coddle them. Forging a path ahead, St. Stephen. It's hard to tell if the sparks flying around Quentin Middleton's head are coming from his brain or the mechanical grinder he uses to smooth a knife blade. In October, Middleton, also a descendant of the Middleton family, opened what may be the nation's only black-owned retail knife shop. The work happens in his St. Stephen workshop, where he produces Middleton-made's workhorse chef's knife, its Japanese cousin, the Giotto, knives with wood handles made colorful by a fungus, and his own invention, a combo oyster shucker bottle opener for those who want a beer with their bivalves. You have to be a metallurgist, a carpenter, a visionary. You have to see it before you make it, he says. The same applies to his career. Historic Charleston once teemed with black iron workers, brick masons, and blacksmiths. He saw their modern counterparts and relatives who held down blue-collar jobs. He relished TV and films of his childhood, where the Ninja Turtles and Luke Skywalker jousted with swords and sabers. A chance encounter with a sword and knife maker as a teenager mall worker launched a future designing bespoke and collectible cutlery. He prayed for a way to become a knife maker, and the Holy Spirit told him to make chef's knives. Asked how knives could be his art and living, he simply says, faith. Because if a clear path doesn't exist, sometimes you have to forge one. Bar hopping and oyster popping, King Street. It was a Monday in oyster season, so Brittany Wall was shucking mollusk at Charleston's Republic Garden and Lounge. Her business, Shucktown Mobile Oyster Bar, pops up at the King Street Eatery and throughout the city. Once a shucker at a restaurant who sold 1,000 oysters a night, she took mere seconds to pop open local Low Country cups and Beausoleil oysters from Canada. All the while, she washed a portable grill where other oysters warmed under smoked Gouda and bacon. Wall crafts cocktail-inspired sauces, pineapple and jalapeno, mimosa, watermelon with basil, all with champagne vinaigrette and easy references for Charleston's dedicated bar hoppers. Wearing a t-shirt that says, "We shuck 'em, you suck 'em," Wall explains that she tinkers with tradition. Food isn't meant to stay the same forever. It changes with the people who cook it and enjoy it. I like to think I'm helping move Low Country traditions forward by adding my own flavor and perspective to the mix. At the end of the day, she just wants to keep the spirit of Low Country food alive. That was the article, How These Black Culinary Entrepreneurs Keep History Alive in South Carolina's Low Country. It was written by Cynthia Greenlee and published February 28, 2025 at the website bonappetit.com. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.